Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new podcast interview in the New Books in East Asian Studies series. Today, I am honored to talk to Qingyuan Cheng from the Chinese University of Hong Kong, who, together with Wing Kung Lam, is co-editor of Globalizing Japanese Philosophy as an Academic Discipline, which was published in 2017. Hello, CY.
Hello, Roman.
Thank you so much for accepting our invitation.
Yes, thank you for having me today.
What we usually do at the beginning of the interview is we ask our interlocutor to introduce themselves. So if you could tell us a few things about yourself, how you became interested in Japanese philosophy, how you got involved in this field.
So I was born in Hong Kong. And I had my university course in Hong Kong. I received my bachelor degree of arts working on philosophy. So in Hong Kong, we study Chinese philosophy, and also we study Western philosophy from Plato to Heidegger. So after 3 years of study of Heidegger, and I continue to study philosophy in the postgraduate master course. When at that time I study Max Scheler phenomenologies, which is less famous than Husserl or Heidegger, but I work on master thesis on Max Scheler. So at that time, I realized that when I studied phenomenology or the reception of phenomenology in Asia, I realized that there is a long tradition of phenomenological research in Japan. But I think this tradition is not almost completely ignored by the academia in the Chinese-speaking world. So in the year 2000, I managed to get a scholarship to study in Japan. So at the time, I would like to explore how the Japanese philosopher studied phenomenology. And then later, under the supervision of Professor Noe of Tohoku University, where I studied, I realized that a Japanese philosopher called Nishida Kitaro, he studied some phenomenology, but actually he continued to develop his idea. So he's not just a researcher of phenomenology, but also a Japanese philosopher. So I spent 7 years in Japan and finished my PhD doctorate dissertation on Nishida Kitaro. So after that, that was in 2007. After that, I came back to Hong Kong, and then I began my career of teaching philosophy in the Department of Philosophy. And a couple of years ago, I shift my department to the Department of Japanese Studies. So this is my career as a for now.
Okay. Now the book we're talking about today is called Globalizing Japanese Philosophy as an Academic Discipline. And when I looked at the structure of the book, I saw that there are two parts. The first part deals with teaching and research in Japanese philosophy in a global world, whereas the second part talks about Japanese philosophy as an academic discipline. And I would like to hear more about the book, about the structure of the book, about the contributors. But before that, I would like to ask you how this idea about this book came about. How was this project born?
Okay, that will be a long story, but I will try to make it short.
Okay.
And after I work as a lecturer in Hong Kong, and obviously I began to teach philosophy. And at the same time, I, as a young scholar, I need to do some research about Japanese philosophy. So, but in the very early stage of my career, I realized that sometimes you have a kind of conflict between teaching and research. So there's a kind of saying that, okay, publish or perish. So it means that most of the younger scholars nowadays will spend a lot of time writing philosophical papers. I myself wrote a lot of papers since I was a postgraduate student. But that may not necessarily be related to your teaching. So in I think the first few years of my career, I struggle a lot about this conflict. And in my teaching, I think the teaching workload was in the beginning was quite demanding, and then also I tried to teach Japanese philosophy, but at that time we didn't have a lot of good references, so it was really hard to teach. So there's a turning point that in 2011, the source book, the Japanese philosophy, a source book, published by edited by James Isaac, Marado, and Kasulis. This is, I think, the milestone of Japanese philosophical research. And with this source book, I guess we can know this will be a huge difference in teaching Japanese philosophy. So, source book, of course, will be a kind of teaching material, but at the end of the day, it will also shift and change the research world. There will be more research students or even scholars who will be reading the source book and develop their new ideas. So to celebrate the publication of the source book, so we organize a conference. So this conference is actually a celebration of the source book. And I myself was also involved in the source book project. I at the time I would like to invite Professor James Heisek to come to Hong Kong and deliver a keynote speech about how the source book can change the teaching of Japanese philosophy. And the other keynote speaker was Professor Fujita Masakazu, who at the time was the professor of the Department of Japanese Philosophy in Kyoto University. So I hope we can get a balance between teaching and research. And also we would like to have different scholars from different continents to work together to develop new ideas. That's why and share our experience of teaching Japanese philosophy. That's why the conference was actually divided into two parts, the teaching part and the research part. And that is represented in the book, in the first part, about the teaching or the teaching experience of Japanese philosophy in different areas. And in the second part of the book, we discuss about how Japanese philosophy can develop as a so-called academic discipline, which is a kind of, a kind of idea developed in the past couple of years. At the time, we realized that the source book is important, but it's not enough because we needed to work on a journal. We need to propose a new journal on Japanese philosophy. So 2011 was the year we received the new journal contract. So in a couple of years, we will be editing the Journal of Japanese Philosophy published by SUNY Press. So this conference is quite special because this is the first time all the journal members came together in Hong Kong and discussed what we can do in the future. So with the source book published, and then we have a new journal to be published, we try to understand Japanese philosophy no longer in Japan, but it's now a kind of global phenomena. So we are trying to develop Japanese philosophy, not in a narrow sense, but we would like to explore different ideas of Japanese philosophy with scholars all over the world. So the journal is important. And later we also established book series on Japanese philosophy. So there is actually some change in the English speaking world, and this is a kind of phenomena that I will say this is a kind of globalizing Japanese philosophy as an academic discipline. And that is a kind of experience that actually happened many decades ago, after the publication of the source book on Chinese philosophy or the source book on Indian philosophy, the Western world actually have more and more scholars working on Chinese and Indian philosophies. And that is not just about teaching, but in research, there is a change. So we expect the publication of the Japanese philosophy source book will also trigger a kind of change in the research world. And that is why we wanted to suggest this is a kind of, academic discipline. In the past, we don't know how we can, where we submit our paper on this either. because we don't have a specific journal on Japanese philosophy. Now we have this journal, and that is, a kind of background of or why we organize a conference about Japanese philosophy in Hong Kong. That's
okay. I have to say, I'm actually glad you mentioned the conflict between what you have to teach and your research. The fact that the things that you have to teach, the courses that you have to teach, are not always related to your research. I think this is a conflict that a lot of young scholars actually relate to. I myself, I have to confess that I do relate to this, conflict. And going back to the book, if I understand correctly, you see this book together with a journal as part of this growing, I don't know if it's a trend yet, this movement, this attempt to promote Japanese philosophy as part of philosophy, as part of global philosophy. Am I correct in my understanding?
I'm not sure if we are actually doing a kind of global philosophy, but as far as I know, there is a lot of new trends to study the non-Western traditions of philosophy. So I hope it will make a difference, because in the past, when we talk about philosophy, we just mention, philosophers from Plato to Heidegger. And of course, these are regarded as Japanese philosophy. Western philosophy. But the non-Western philosophers, or of course, also the women philosophers, they are all not just underestimated, but in most cases, completely ignored in the academic world. So, globalizing Japanese philosophy is a project to make a difference in, stating that there is the Japanese philosophy. And in the past, it was ignored, but now I think we should regulate and understand it in a more, broader sense, with scholars from different continents. We would like to understand it is a kind of global phenomenon. But at the same time, I have to say, I realize the problem of this globalization. We all know that globalization will lead to a kind of single standard, and in the academic world, we all actually realize that globalization is destroying a lot of local possibilities. So all these local universities now they have to look for a kind of global standard to standardize their research, to rank the universities in the global ranking game. And that is why actually we actually planned to invite Professor Sakabe Megumi to Hong Kong to talk about the problem of globalization. But unfortunately, Professor Sakabe passed away before the conference, so it's really unfortunate that we couldn't have him. And with Professor Sakabeth thought. I think we would like to, in this book, it is a very nice article written by Professor Kobayashi on Sakabeth's philosophy. The important philosophy here is that Professor Sakabeth perhaps is one of the frontiers of, you know, globalizing Japanese philosophy. He had a lot of research students, foreign students studied under him, and he had a lot of papers published in different languages. But he is actually, at the same time, he realized the problem of, you know, just using Western language to work on Japanese philosophy. So it could destroy a kind of, you know, traditions that in, you know, philosophy in many places they are not doing in a more, you know, dominant language. They're not doing the philosophy in English only. So there are different places. In, for example, I can imagine in Eastern Europe, these philosophers they study philosophy in their own language. In Hong Kong, also we study philosophy in our native Hong Kong Chinese Cantonese languages. But in, you know, a more you know, trend of globalization, there is a possibility that, okay, now we have an English journal, we have more English speaking scholars working on Japanese philosophy. But at the same time, we may see that, you know, maybe there will be no more people working on the Japanese philosophy in a more Japanese, you know, sense. So globalization is something that we thought we needed to do something, because if we are not setting up this journal, Japanese philosophy will be as, you know, weak as before. So we need to do something. But at the same time, we realize that when we are doing globalization, globalizing Japanese philosophy, we could destroy some local philosophic projects. So that is, I think, the two sides of globalizing Japanese philosophy. At the same time, at the time we published this book, we hope we can just bring it as a kind of possibility. So we hope this is a new trend of doing Japanese philosophy in a more globalized context, but we didn't develop into a world philosophy. And at the same time, we understand there could be a problem in, you know, linking Japanese philosophy and globalization.
Okay, I see. Because you mentioned the conference and the fact that Professor Heisig was a keynote speaker at the conference you organized, I remember that in his article, in his paper, which is an essay, which is actually included in your book. It's actually the first essay included in the first part. That discusses teaching and research about Japanese philosophy in a global world. Professor Heisig talks about two major obstacles. He calls them obstacles that he identifies that would that obstacles that prevent Western researchers, Western scholars, Western professors from including Japanese philosophy in their syllabus, in the curriculum at their universities. And if I remember correctly, I think the first obstacle that he mentions is this resistance to the idea that something that's outside the Western tradition, Western intellectual history, can be called a philosophy in the strict sense of the word. And the second obstacle that he mentions is the fact that many times these professors, they're not trained. They don't know how to begin training themselves in a different philosophical tradition. So, for example, if they're specialized in continental philosophy, they don't know how to read, interpret Japanese philosophy, for example. This also the premise of the first part of this book?
That is, of course, a very important point raised by Professor Heisig, and I think he also mentioned one important point by Professor Kalsudis. So, when we talk about these kind of, you know, non-Western philosophies, we thought that these are, you know, completely different. They have a different language, and I don't know this language, so I don't know how to recognize. I don't have any reference. So some of them, they prefer not to mention about these, you know, non-Western philosophy. But Professor Carl Solis mentioned this problem of, for example, Kierkegaard. So he's a Danish philosopher. So these are within these Western traditions, but they will not be writing philosophy in English, for example. So still there are people that cannot read Kierkegaard in his original Danish or German text. So I think a problem of not just about, you know, Western or non-Western. This is a problem of translation. This is also discussed in Professor Heisig's paper, Can a Philosophy Be Translated? And it also discussed by Professor Weihaler in her paper about, you know, understanding Japanese philosophy in relationship to these kind of translational studies. So the problem is we are working on in the world with a kind of with a very dominant major language, that is English. So source book first is, you know, translating Japanese text to English language. So we have a huge group of scholars from different continents, but the working language is English. So that is the kind of as I mentioned earlier, this is what we called globalization. So this is turning out to be an English project. But at the same time, Sourcebook is quite interesting because later it was also translated into Spanish. And also there is a group of scholars working on a Chinese translation of the Sourcebook. There's also a Korean group of scholars working on a Korean translation of Sourcebook. So Sourcebook supposed to be a text in English, but now there could be other scholars. Of course, they can read the text in English, but we can also look for the possibilities of translating Sourcebook into different language. And that is, again, a kind of a great opportunity to understand how Japanese philosophy can be translated. In some cases, it's quite tricky because in the Chinese translation, and for example, translating Ito Jinzai or Oku Sola, in some cases, actually, it's even much easier to not translating the text because Oku Sola, Jinzai, they wrote the text in Asian Chinese style. We call it the Kanbun. And perhaps rather than translating the English translation back to Chinese, we can actually skip this English translation and return to the original text. So this is a translation of not translating something, a translation project of understanding. There is a kind of new understanding, for example, in the English translation. In English translated text, but different language groups may have different ideas about how they translate English Japanese philosophy. So now the situation is quite interesting, and because of this source book, we triggered some local research groups. So globalization was the beginning, but I hope it will not turn it into just a kind of global trend, but in future we hope to have more and more local scholars reacting on this globalizing Japanese philosophy project.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay. Since you mentioned the local research projects, research groups, the local scholars working on Japanese philosophy, if you look at the list of contributors to the book, if you look at their affiliation, you actually have researchers from Japan, but also from Spain, University of Guam, for example, from the United States, but also from China, also from Hong Kong, and so on and so forth. So it seems to me that it's a very global and at the same time local group. This you wanted this to happen, right? You wanted to. Is my understanding correct that you wanted to have a group as diverse as possible to contribute to the book?
Yes, that was our intention.
Okay, and I have a question about the first part of the book. First, focusing on teaching Japanese philosophy, I think that's one of the most original points of the book. I don't. I have to confess, I haven't seen this idea discussed in a lot of other books. What was your purpose? Why did you want to focus on this teaching Japanese philosophy?
Okay. One strict forward reason is that Japanese philosophy, I think 10 years ago, was not even taught in many institutes. So it is a kind of rare experience. I think, well, of course, there may be more people who actually taught Japanese philosophy, but I think the contributors here were more or less the same. They could actually teach in their own in their own universities. So we tried to share our experience of how to teach. At the time, we didn't have the source book, so we hoped we can share our experience or pain of, you know, teaching with our decent teaching material. And also, when teaching Japanese philosophy, there is always a kind of problem of, you know, how to select, you know, the, just for example, just the Kyoto school philosophers, or should we include the pre-modern thinkers, the Confucian thinkers, or the Buddhist thinkers? So this is the kind of you know, practical problem that we all are actually interested in, and there must be a lot of point of discussing that. So that was the original ideas. I myself has been teaching Japanese philosophy in Hong Kong for a couple of years. But before the conference, I didn't have a lot of chance to teach. So actually, that was also my own, you know, will to learn from other scholars, to learn from you know, how they teach Japanese philosophy. I think they are really experienced scholars, and in the conference we didn't mention about teaching of Japanese philosophy in Japan. So in this book we actually invite a young scholar, Satofumi Kawamura, to contribute a book chapter especially for this book, because we also would like to learn how Japanese philosophy is taught in Japan or not taught in Japan.
Okay. I have to confess, I asked this question because as I was going through the essays in the first part, I actually found a lot of ideas and a lot of tips, a lot of information about how to create a syllabus, how to teach Japanese philosophy. And in the essays, the authors discuss teaching and research in Belgium, Canada, France, but also in Spain and English-speaking countries, and also in Japan. So there's a whole it's a wide range of there's a whole lot of information there, and it was very useful for me, and I think it's useful for a lot of young scholars who start teaching Japanese philosophy. So I guess I have to thank you for this.
Thank you for point. And but one problem is that the conference was organized in 2011, and because of all different problems in looking for publication funding and delayed in receiving some of the book chapters, we could only manage to publish the book in 2017. So you may find some of the materials here not, you know, cannot cover the latest development in this area of Japanese philosophy. But that is, I think, the general problem of, you know, book publication. So for the latest developments, I think we can now rely more on the internet publication or journals. Not just about the journals of Japanese philosophy, but we also have this European Journal for Japanese philosophy, which is, I think, a very important project. And there are research group behind the ENOJP, is a European network on Japanese philosophy. They are a group of very important and young scholars who eagerly working on bringing up scholars in Europe and actually from outside Europe to discuss Japanese philosophy in their regular meetings in Europe. I think next year they will have the meeting in Japan, but I think it is also, I would say this is another globalizing Japanese philosophy project.
Yes, I agree with you. I think I had this feeling that a lot of good things are actually happening in this field of Japanese philosophy right now with, as you were saying, a lot of young scholars becoming more and more involved and networking across continents. But going back to the book, I also have a question about the second part, and where you have essays written by different authors on different Japanese philosophers. And most of the, I couldn't help but notice that most of the philosophers that the authors write about are modern or contemporary philosophers, like, for example, Nishida Kitaro, Suzuki Daisetsu, also Nishiyamane, Kuki Shuzo, Tanabe Hajime, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, I noticed that some of the authors, they try to make this connection, this link between Japanese modern contemporary philosophy and pre-modern thought, pre-modern philosophy. For example, Confucianism or Buddhism. And my question to you would be if you feel that this is something important, you feel that this is to create this link between modern Japanese philosophy and pre-modern Japanese philosophy. Is this something that has to be done? Is this something that's important?
I believe that what we call about Japanese philosophy is not limited to modern Japanese philosophy. Perhaps in Japan, when we talk about Tetsugaku, they will say, okay, this is a word translated by Nishi Aname, Amane, and it is only a word translated or coined in the late 19th century. So before this word Tetsugaku was translated, there was no Tetsugaku, right? But since I believe there's a broader sense of Japanese philosophy that will be including all this pre-modern, they call it a thought, what he saw. So with a broader definition of Japanese philosophy, including the pre-modern thought and the modern or even the contemporary philosophies. So I think we have a broader picture of what is going on about these, you know, Japanese philosophers. And I believe that there could be some continuity, even since in the modern thinkers, for example, Nishida, for example, he is a modern thinker in the so-called Kyoto school philosophy, but without all these pre-modern concepts in Buddhism or Confucianism or even from Kokugaku, we have some difficulties in understanding Nishida. So I myself would like to understand Japanese philosophy in this broader sense, and that is something I learned actually from the source book, because the source book also include all these pre-modern thought, and they believe these are also Japanese philosophers. So Kukai, for example, is one of the earliest Japanese philosopher included in the source book. But the interesting thing is that the Kukai may not be regarded as a philosopher in Japan, but how we can understand his death as a philosophy. This is, again, a very interesting point. Well, I also have to confess that we have enough book chapters on the pre-modern part of Japanese philosophy in this book. So it's something that we would like to do in future book projects. So I hope my definition is a kind of, you know, a broader sense, and it's a kind of working definition that we can include even, you know, disciplines. So one interesting group of thinkers would be the for example, the Minzokugaku, folklore studies thinkers. They are not included in the philosophy textbook or text, but maybe their thoughts can also be understood as a philosophy. One important thinker could be Yanakita Kuniyo. He's not a philosopher, but maybe we can understand his ideas in a more philosophical way. So these will be the kind of Japanese philosophy we may develop in the future.
So your approach to Japanese philosophy is very inclusive, not only modern philosophy, but also pre-modern texts or texts from other fields. I have one last question about the book. If you want your readers to take away something, one thing from your book, what would that thing be? What do you want your readers to take away from this book?
One important ideas here in the book will be Japanese philosophy as a kind of well, of course it is a theory, it is a kind of philosophical argumentations and thought and theories and all these kind of, you know, we call it a theoretical philosophy. But I hope we also demonstrate that philosophy is not just a kind of theory. We need to understand how it changed the world. And in this book, we try to demonstrate that. We try to at least teach Japanese philosophy. So teaching is not just a theory, but it's an action. Teaching Japanese philosophy is not just, you know, reading the text only, but as some of our contributors mentioned, we need to have some actions of, you know, visiting some site or to understand how these Japanese movement can act on their everyday living. So I hope they can understand this Japanese philosophy is not just a theory, but would be a kind of practice or action. And that is, I think, one important point mentioned also by, for example, Professor Marado in his other article. He mentioned that Japanese philosophy is, of course, a bunch of theories, but it is a kind of new movement that we would like to make it more so-called practical. So that is also the one of the points I would like to mention. And I would like to have our readers to think about it. And perhaps, if possible, we can act or to do Japanese philosophy in the future. Not just about reading the text, but we call into actions after studying Japanese philosophy.
Okay, so not just read, but also act. Okay. Okay. Now, we're kind of running out of time. We're approaching the end of this interview. And I actually wanted to ask you about your plans for the future. What's on the horizon for you? I know we actually met this summer at a conference in Mexico, and we started talking a little bit. You told me a little bit about your plans for the future. If you could give us some details about what's on the horizon for you.
Perfect. And it was a great academic meeting in Mexico. During this seminar, I deliver talk on philosophy and disaster. So we knew that earlier this year in Mexico there was a huge earthquake and also a week before the conference there was also a huge earthquake in Osaka. And when coming back to this book, it was published in 2011. So that was also the year of the Great East Japan Earthquake. So after these 3/11, I began to think about what actually philosophy is. So it's just a as mentioned earlier, it's just a theory about different philosophers, or is that a kind of philosophy that can be related to our contemporary world? This is a world full of, you know, not just disasters, but also now we have this problem of wars, conflicts, and, you know, the problem of capitalism, and our, you know, this is a world full of different, you know, injustice and inequalities. So, so I propose we can, based on, you know, for example, Wajiji's reflections on this pilgrimage to the Asian temples. In Japanese, Koji Junne. So, in reading Wajiji's text, I came out with a conclusion that reading philosophy is, of course, important, but at the time we can also do philosophy by visiting the temples or the shrines. So, these kind of visit, we call it a pilgrimage. It's of course sounds like just like a religious practice, but I would like to further develop it as a kind of philosophy, which is not just about reading texts, but it is about how we can recollect something which is completely forgotten in the world. So in going into the temple, we can try to read the forgotten traditions of for example, Buddhism. That was Wajiji's project. Or if we visit some temples destroyed by a tsunami after the 3/11, we can understand there is a problem of, you know, recovering, or the problem of reconstruction in contemporary Japanese society. So philosophy is not just about reading the text, but we can do Japanese philosophy in visiting all these places. There could be a famous temple or a completely ignored temple. That is the kind of philosophy that I am working on, the philosophy of pilgrimage. So we also have our good friends and colleagues, Takeshi Morisato. He's also now working on this Shikoku pilgrimage project, and it was also a project to me highly important. And this is also a chance after this, you know, pilgrimage, and then we may also come back to this Kukai's philosophy. So again, now we can come back to the text of Kukai, and then we can do philosophy in the temples. So that is the kind of philosophy, theory and actions that we can work on, work together in the future.
Mm-hmm. So it's a philosophy of pilgrimage, but at the same time, a philosophy through pilgrimage.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. As you were saying earlier, not just reading, not just thinking about philosophy, but also acting.
Yeah. And as now we are teaching Japanese philosophy. So in teaching Japanese philosophy, it is already a kind of action. So of course, there are different teaching styles. People may just read a paper in his or her lecture, but I hope I can develop a kind of teaching style of not just finishing a text in a semester. A teaching could be a kind of continual way of understanding philosophy. So teaching is inside the classroom, and at the same time, we can do the teaching outside the classroom. So this is the kind of action that I am also doing, and I believe that you are also doing the same in your classroom and outside the classroom, of course.
Yes. going back to our discussion in Mexico, I remember we talked a bit about Japanese philosophy, but also about other traditions, about trying to include, for example, in this idea of world philosophy, in this concept of world philosophy, of also including not only Japanese philosophy or Chinese philosophy or Indian philosophy, but also local intellectual traditions like Latin America and so on and so forth. Is this something that you plan to work on, or is it another direction of your research? Or
so the kind of that would be related to how we can understand or we think about philosophy through pilgrimages. So if these pilgrimages not just about Japan or in Japan, there are other destination of pilgrimage that we can trigger other kind of philosophical thinking. So these pilgrimage may include, for example, some temples in Hong Kong or in China, and in not far future. So actually in January, I'm going to work with actually one of the contributors of this book, with Gary Onkoff. I will work with him again to bring students to different places in Japan, Hong Kong, and China. We are doing a pilgrimage to study how philosophy and different pilgrimage can link together. So we are going to visit places destroyed, devastated by tsunami in the Tohoku area in Japan. Also, we are also going to Nagasaki, Hiroshima, to let the students understand what is going on after these atomic bombs. And also we are trying to recall some lost heritage in Hong Kong, and then in China we are going to visit some Zen or the Chan temples in Canton province, and also to study what happened in Nanjing. So this sounds like, you know, well, it is not my plan, but Gary really would like to travel all these places in just 3 weeks' time. So that will be a very demanding trip. But I guess we can actually learn a lot from this pilgrimage. And I always believe that reading is important, but after reading, it is always important to go to the exact, you know, location and site to understand what is going on. So this is the kind of ideas you can find in Japanese word gemba. So gemba is a place, but it is also the bar is a place, but gemba is like the place in front of you. So philosophy, what is the gemba? The gemba, I think for many of us, this is the classroom. Some of them, they prefer to stay in the office because they think research is more important than teaching. But I believe there's supposed to be a balance. And also, the gemba is also outside the campus. So I hope we can find some way of doing philosophy if we travel to temples or even to some of the places ignored by all these, you know, heritage recommendations. There's still the gambas. We can always find something. Even in the neighborhood, in our own neighborhood, there could be some kind of you know, places that will trigger our philosophical thinking.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're running out of time. We're going to have to stop the interview. Thank you very much for talking to us. Good luck with all your research projects from now on. For our listeners, we were talking to Qingyun Cheng from the Chinese University of Hong Kong, who, together with Wing Keng Lam, is co-editor of Globalizing Japanese Philosophy as an Academic Discipline, a book that was published in 2017. But as you heard in the interview, it's based on a conference that took place in 2011. Thank you very much, CY.
Thank you, Roman, for having me today with you. And I enjoyed talking to you, and hope we can continue our dialogue in future.
Let's hope so. I'm looking forward to reading your next book.
Thank you so much.